Welcome to the Eco News Report. I'm Kirk Cahoon of Greenway Partners. In our ongoing series on innovation in the environment, we are profiling the people, ideas, and projects that are taking an innovative approach to dealing with our local and global environmental challenges. Today, we're discussing social media, social marketing, and the importance of new communication strategies to environmental advocates and change agents. Joining me in the studio today are Emmanuel Rose of Strategic E-Marketing and David Narum of Greenway Partners. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks, Kirk.
Well, in discussing the world of possibilities brought on by so-called new media, I'd like to read you a quote from Al Gore to get things started. Social media is no less than the democratization of information. What do you think about that?
Well, did Al Gore invent social media?
Just the internet.
Okay, just the internet. Democratization of information. Well, that's interesting, especially in light of what we saw in Egypt just recently, where because of police corruption and police brutality that was posted on YouTube and then subsequently on Facebook and Twitter, an entire regime came down, and we had the opportunity not only to get some facts coming from people on the street, but then also the opportunity to have democracy come into a place that has been under totalitarian rule for a number of decades. So I think Al Gore's right on that one.
All right.
Yeah, I agree. I think the control of information has been one way to maintain power, and the fact that it's become so readily accessible through a variety of means, internet, but also other forms of media, has allowed these power structures allowed them to crumble.
Yeah. Well, this is the Eco News Report. So specifically today, we're going to talk about the relevance to new media and the environment and how some of those issues can be brought out in the new media contexts. You know, Emmanuel, there's a project I know up in Alaska that you're familiar with. I'd like to have you discuss that in a few minutes, but I want you to introduce what Strategic E-Marketing is and what you do.
Well, Strategic E-Marketing, we are integrating social media with traditional media. And what that means is looking at Facebook and Twitter and LinkedIn and Foursquare and Tumblr. And you got any others, David?
I think you've covered.
integrating all these great new services that allow people to express their opinions and then communicate them to their friends and make recommendations, integrating those things into what an organization or a business is using as part of their marketing campaign and communicating in terms of integrating those great services into their traditional media campaign.
Okay. And so give us some examples of what social media is. You mentioned Twitter, Facebook, Tumblr, and those are a number of things that many of us are familiar with. But for those that are not initiated to the new social media, give me an example. What is Twitter?
I find it hard to believe that any of your listeners are not up to speed.
You might be surprised.
You know, I just saw an interesting new study that showed the internet is the primary source of information for people buying any product across all ages. So even people over 65, the internet is their primary source. Social media, Twitter in specific, is an opportunity in 140 characters or less to send a message to people who are following you. And so there's
like they're stalking you or
well, that's a Twitter term for they're in your group of followers. And so, for instance, the Bristol Bay organization has got about 1400 Twitter followers right now. And so if they're having some type of a fundraiser in San Francisco, they would post a message on their Twitter account that said, meet us at a specific restaurant and have some wild salmon from Bristol Bay for dinner.
Okay.
And one thing about Twitter, too, I think, is it sort of vets who has something to say, because if you don't, you're not going to have a lot of followers. So, I mean, I think one person might think, Twitter, I mean, what do I have? What's 140 characters going to offer me? In many cases, it doesn't offer you anything. So,
well, in some cases, it's a perfect platform because Ashton Kutcher is one of the most followed people on Twitter.
And that's about all he would have to say that I'd want to hear is about 140 characters long. So, you mentioned Bristol Bay. Now, I want to talk to you a little bit about this. This is a really unique part of Alaska that is currently subject to the planning phase for a mine called the Pebble Mine that many of our listeners are familiar with. And can you kind of update us on where that project stands right now and what is the project proposing to do?
Well, the project is basically being funded by a consortium of British mining companies and Canadian mining companies to go into part of Alaska that's called Bristol Bay. And that part of Alaska is the world's largest salmon fishery on the planet. It's the biggest, most productive salmon fishery. And they're saying, hey, we want to go in there and build this 15-mile-long sulfur mine, put in the world's largest dam, bigger than the Three Gorges or anything that's happened in Brazil up to date, so that we can pull out copper, gold, and some other materials. Of course, like most of Alaska, there's seismic activity from volcanoes, and there's a lot of knowns, and there's a lot of unknown knowns.
Oh, no, you're going Rumsfeld on us here. Oh, no. Okay, well, so the Pebble Mine, in the most recent National Geographic, I believe it was the January issue, had a long article about the Pebble Mine and what's proposed there. And, you know, the Bristol Bay salmon fishery, as you mentioned, is the world's most abundant fishery, and something like 12 million returning sockeye salmon every year, and just enormous numbers of fish, just like we had here at one point in time, we no longer have. And so for a lot of people, it's really hard to imagine a worse place to put an open pit copper and gold mine than in Bristol Bay.
I think for just about anybody who's not a shareholder of the companies that are proposing this thing. Yeah. And if you've ever seen pictures of the bears eating salmon and those are typically out of Bristol Bay also.
Right.
So there's major impacts that haven't been researched, and consequently, in order to get the word out, savebristolbay.org was created, a website as part of Trout Unlimited, and then a number of corporate partners have stepped up as well. Of course, Patagonia and Orvis, and they're driving their customers both to the site and then also to Facebook and Twitter and even YouTube.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so get a little specific here on how social marketing is being used in this issue. You mentioned some of these corporate partners, Patagonia and Orvis. So give us an example of how this might work. If I was a person, say, living in Alaska and I wanted to draw attention to this issue, how would I use these tools, these social media tools, to draw attention from the world to this issue?
Well, one way that people are having fundraisers up there, and then they're posting that information to Facebook. And when you're posting that information, then all your followers and all those followers end up finding out about that also. So you've got that leverage of Facebook. You've also got, if you have a Twitter account and you want to pass on information that's coming out, like there's a vote coming up or there's a certain senator from Alaska who's making comments about it, you can pass those on either through email or through Facebook or for your own Twitter.
And one of the values of Facebook, as far as I understand it, Emmanuel, is that when somebody posts something, people can share it and it automatically emerges into another network of followers of, you know, for that person or friends, for example, then it can keep propagating through these networks. And that's where it gets viral, right? Is that the term?
Yeah, the viral marketing, where things take on an exponential nature. And, you know, instead of just seeing the cute kitten video from YouTube or something, you're able to actually pass on the valuable information about the social issues.
Okay.
To your group and, like David was saying, to spheres outside of that.
Okay. And David, you're involved in something that many people may not be familiar with. Community-based social marketing is another tool that's often used to drive change and drive information about, you know, proposed projects or about ideas.
Right. Often what community-based social marketing is trying to do is a change behavior among people, whether for, you know, positive health outcomes or socially beneficial outcomes, for example, environmental related behaviors, such as, you know, how you use your energy or what, you know, if you waste things at home that you could recycle, or purchasing patterns, use of plastic bags in grocery stores, these kinds of things. The reason why, you know, it's probably mistermed marketing in some senses, but it's, what it's doing is it's using the tools that were developed by business marketing, which are very successful tools in terms of getting people to purchase items or change behaviors in certain ways. And the basic definition of it is the use of marketing principles to influence human behavior to improve health or to benefit society. So Emmanuel can probably talk to a lot of these as well. The idea behind it is that it's really driven by evidence of what works and addressing the behaviors. Like, why don't we all, some of us who maybe know that plastic bags are kind of a bad idea, nonetheless use them from the grocery store? Why do we leave lights on or, you know, drive unnecessarily? I mean, this kind of thing. They're often used in stopping cigarette smoking and other health campaigns. So
okay.
That's the idea.
Well, and usually people are looking at either, when you're developing a campaign like that, it's going to be the carrot or the stick, right?
We're going
to have an incentive in order to create pleasure, or we're going to create a disincentive by pointing out the pain and then creating some type of a call to action.
Yeah, and I think that there's a lot of things that you could mandate change, which would make social marketing programs unnecessary. I mean, you could just simply say that you can't produce plastic bags and stores can't provide them for you. And that would make, you know, that's one way to ease that burden. But there are many things in society that simply just can't be mandated. And so, you know, how do you change the norms of what is acceptable behavior versus not? And, you know, I think that is sort of what I think a lot of marketing tries to do, is change what is perceived as normal behavior. And there's a lot of crafty strategies to do it.
It's funny. It's almost like using the dark arts for a higher purpose.
Yeah.
You know, so much of marketing has been directed towards selling us things we don't need and towards things that are destructive. And Emmanuel, I want to get back to you for a second. Strategic e-marketing is just one of your interests. You're also quite a fisherman and a fly fisherman at that. So you have another business venture that you're involved in. I want you to talk a little bit about Steelhead Only.
Well, at Steelhead Only, we are focused on steelhead fly fishing and getting out on adventures, either here locally on the Klamath River or else getting out to the Umpqua, the Deschutes, or even up to BC and up onto the Bulkley River. Mm. And so part of, I think, being an eco-green type person is getting out and spending time outside. And we spend all this time lamenting what we've lost and sending money out to important organizations. And I think it's super important to get out and enjoy being out there.
So okay. If I'm speaking from a social marketing perspective, Emmanuel, what are the barriers to people doing that type of behavior that's keeping them from getting out there?
Well, there are a lot of things, actually. In fly fishing, for instance, there is a decreasing market. Every year, there's fewer and fewer fly fishermen. And there's a big push from the Outdoor Industries Association to change that. One of the things they're doing is they're creating mentor programs in order to teach kids how to do certain skills, backpacking, even camping, and, of course, fishing and hunting.
So that's just awareness raising in some ways, huh?
It is, and it's also motivating individuals who grew up in a lifestyle that maybe they don't have children of their own or their children are grown to then go and teach other people how to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And so from a perspective of the marketing angle, you've got, it seems to me, a captive audience of fishermen that are more passionately concerned about fish, water quality, and the survival of our local rivers and our regional rivers than almost any other group, really. You know, maybe farmers obviously have an issue of they need water as well. But, you know, in terms of some of the regional rivers that we've got here, like the Klamath and then the Eel and the Mad, of course, the Klamath specifically has got some issues, obviously, around dam removal that seem to be continuously in the news. As a fisherman, what are some of the things that you've observed there on the Klamath River? I know that's one of your favorite spots to go.
Well, it is. It's the most remote and accessible, and it sounds funny, but remote and accessible river in our area. What we notice is that most of the fishermen and fishing guides are obviously for the dam removal because it's going to benefit the fish, even though it's going to change dramatically the way that the river acts and behaves and that we've become familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we've been under dam management for 4 or 5 decades now. Once it comes back after 2020, hopefully, to more of a seasonal river, then it's going to change the way that the fish cycles happen. It won't be as consistent, obviously. The fishing won't be. So it's going to change dramatically a lot about how we interact with the river.
Mm-hmm.
And there's even, you know, there's two sides saying, well, there's not going to be enough water even to have it float all the way from the headwaters to the mouth of the ocean. And then there's the other side that says, well, there's all these springs that are underwater right now.
Mm-hmm.
So there's, you know, there's debate in that community also about the benefits and what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You're listening to the Eco News Report. I'm your host, Kurt Cahoon of Greenway Partners. Joining me today are Emmanuel Rose of Strategic E-Marketing and David Narum of Greenway Partners. And, you know, David, as far as the community-based social marketing goes, can you give us a project that you are aware of where some of these principles were put into action and maybe some of the outcomes that were derived from them?
Well, I know one that's underway in the planning stage right now. The group of students at Humboldt State University trying to figure out basically what I was talking about earlier, ways to address plastic bag use. And it's a funny problem because it's a seemingly somewhat innocuous behavior, and we all engage in it, I think. Well, a lot of us do. I shouldn't say everybody. There's people that are very conscientious about bringing the bag that they have, you know, the reusable bag. But then there's people that have, you know, 20 reusable bags at home, and they get to the store and they don't have one of them with them. And it really just kind of illustrates, I think, well, the problem of you know, habit, how strongly we are sort of stuck in our habits in life. And, you know, changing behavior is really not as easy as it might seem. I think a lot of default ideas were, you know, provide information or education about, say, for example, greenhouse gases. Mm-hmm. You know, just tell the public that, you know, the parts per million of greenhouse gases have risen by 140 since the Industrial Revolution. It, you know, you get eyes starting to glaze over, and it's not going to
make eyes people glazing over.
Yeah,
now,
people aren't going to rush out and change their behaviors necessarily. So, right. You know, what are the tricks? And I'd say that not like we're being deceitful, I think, in the marketing, but what are the tricks of the trade that, you know, allows people to see a new behavior in a different light to make it fit into their existing norms, which it has to do, has to provide them something in exchange for the behavior that they're giving up. They have to receive something of value. It can't just be, you know, you have to do this because otherwise you're an environmental criminal. It's craftily suggesting that these are the benefits, and you can do it through visual images. The bag, the life cycle of the plastic bag often is where it ends up in this large mid-ocean trash pit. And I think people aren't really aware of that, the volume of plastic that's out there. And yeah. There's a wonderful video about, you know, sort of treating plastic bags like a wild creature. You know, they're born and then they fly free once they're used and they're gone and they're off to their home in the middle of the ocean, which is a nice way to kind of make people think differently about the use of them.
Right. The ubiquity of plastic in the world is something that's been commented on by a lot of folks.
Yeah.
Another area I've noticed the community-based social marketing has been utilized is in the development of energy efficiency programs. And I know one of the biggest challenges of getting widespread energy efficiency programs throughout the country is consumer behavior. There's a lot of issues. You want to spend the money up front to retrofit your house and do solar panels and all that kind of stuff. It's expensive. So if we can overcome the expensive part, get some money for people to do those things, there's still going to be barriers to acceptance. What we find, and I think a lot of the research shows, is that access to information does not drive behavioral change. So can you discuss why, with perfect amounts of information available to people almost all the time, we still continue to make bad decisions or decisions against our own self-interest?
Well, despite hundreds of years of economic research into the rational utility maximizer, we are irrational people and we don't behave necessarily that way. Information just is not received and processed in ways that would logically lead to, you know, an outcome such as, you know, I think you could argue almost across the board that replacing your light bulbs with energy efficient light bulbs, for going right now, the discussion of the problems with CFLs and mercury and the waste, et cetera. But, you know, just on a purely economic basis, it makes complete sense, almost always beating the stock market in your return on your investment, and minor inconvenience in terms of replacing your light bulbs, even reducing your maintenance needs because they last 10 times as long. But I think it kind of comes back again to that issue of norms to some degree and perception, you know, the quality in that case. You know, we're talking about light bulbs, but it's a real puzzle. I mean, people are still kind of looking at this. What are the steps that needs to go through? I mean, the alternative has to be better than the other, but it has to be perceived as better. It can't just tell them that. It has to be compatible with what they already believe to be right, what their norms are. It has to not be too difficult to do.
Maybe this is where we get Ashton Kutcher on Twitter and talking about how he's changing all his incandescent bulbs to CFLs and he's doing it with his shirt off and suddenly all his followers are doing the same thing at home. I mean, maybe we have some movement like that to talk about.
Well, I think part of that, the norm changing, is to see other people do it. I mean, the idea that you not just see other people, but see other people that you identify with or whose norms you identify
with. Or you look
with.
Up to.
And it becomes sort of a cascade effect when innovations move through a society or diffuse through a society. There's always that first group, the early adopters that kind of get in soon. And then there's...
These are the guys that bought Betamax and
right.
Oops, like, yeah. Wrong choice.
Yeah. And there's always the people that are a little bit more wary of the new technology. And then it takes a while for norms to change. And so you have the early adopters that follow, or the early majority, late majority, and laggards are what they call the people that in the year 2100 will still be using incandescent bulbs.
Now, as far as marketing goes, Emmanuel, you've talked to me a little bit about some of the principles of marketing, and they're very basic and very simple. Can you just express those for us?
Well, again, we go back to the carrot and the stick. And for instance, we've seen this before with recycling, right? How much recycling was happening before the nickel was put onto each receptacle, you know? So there is both a carrot and a stick simultaneously, because it's costing you on one hand, and then you're receiving some value from it at the end also. But really, marketing boils down to telling a story that shows a problem, that shows a solution, and then gives you a call to action.
And this fits perfectly within the environmental campaigns. If you look at every historical environmental campaign that's been successful, that's literally what they're doing. So we may not be calling these things marketing, but we've really been using marketing principles for quite a long time in environmental campaigns.
Yeah, and the sophisticated part is adapting the story and identifying the way that the story needs to be told to each target audience. You're going to speak differently to a lawmaker than you are to a person out in front of the co-op. And so you've got to have the story, then you've got to figure out how to package the story. And then what's the call to action? Are we looking for a $1,000 donation, or are we looking for somebody to write a bill, or are we looking for somebody to write a grant proposal?
Or to sign a petition in front of the grocery store.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
Well, and let's talk a little bit about more what's going on in Egypt and Libya now and Tunisia. And a simple act, a very desperate act by a fruit seller in Tunisia seems to be the trigger for this widespread revolution throughout the Arab world. And I'm stunned sitting back looking at it. And I don't want to give all of the credit to Facebook and Twitter, but it certainly had a big impact on spreading the message and connecting people in ways they hadn't been connected before.
Even to the point where the country of Egypt said, oops, the internet's down and we didn't do it. And Google stepped in and said, hey, we're going to figure out this thing called speak to tweet. And then we're going to send out the tweets anyway. So social media, there's definitely some people said, you know, Malcolm Gladwell was one who said, hey, come on. Countries have been rising and falling for thousands of years. It's not a big social media revolution. But at the same time, this was a Gutenberg press of its time.
Right.
It was, without it, it would have been a different show.
And the rapidity at which it happened seems, I think, very clearly put that right on the doorstep of social media. You can not communicate in ways that quickly, that easily with people on handheld devices all across the Middle East and the Arab world.
And then it probably went from the e-networks to the face-to-face networks. I mean, there's a whole lot going on there in terms of how that kind of stuff spreads, how revolution spreads.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to the Eco News Report. I'm your host, Kurt Cahoon of Greenway Partners. Joining me today are Emmanuel Rose of Strategic E-Marketing and David Narum of Greenway Partners. We're talking about social media and social marketing. Okay, well, back to the discussion here. So social marketing, David, and we talked a little bit about energy usage. You mentioned there's class at Humboldt State. I know that you're teaching, that you're trying to get your students aware of the principles of social marketing, and you discussed this plastic bag issue. What would be an outcome? I mean, what are you hoping to get people to do if they're exposed to this project, say, at one of the local shopping stores?
Well, the current students are still devising the project, but the outcome, we hope, in a small scale, because it's a short semester and there's only 7 weeks left, is to actually have a visible reduction for at least a day or possibly a week at a local store that's willing to cooperate with us, work with us. And that's the current planning. If it were a full-scale program to be implemented, and we do have a potential client who might take this project on over the long term, you would want to institute ways to measure the impact of the program. So you evaluate, say, plastic bag reduction, which might lead to, you know, ultimately complete policy change, for example, for a local store, or other types of solutions to the problem. One being proposed by the students would be to have, you know, laundered bags that were reusable bags that were simply available at the store. And then when you're like the diaper exchange, you know, you'd bring all your used bags in and they would be, well, they'd be, you know,
clean diapers.
Well, you put your used bags in a bin that they would be laundered and reprovided. So it's not even one or the other. It's a completely different solution. So it's thinking, solving the problem differently. Mm-hmm. But for these purposes, it's just a small scale kind of approach, but with hopefully some visible.
Well, and I think for the environmental movement, in my experience and what I have observed over the years, is that so much of what the environmental movement has tried to do has been in response to top down, you know, trying to get an industry to change their ways or trying to get government to regulate more effectively. But this strategy of accumulating thousands and tens and hundreds of thousands of people almost instantaneously on an issue, to me seems like a whole new opportunity. And we discuss environmental campaigns. And, you know, Manuel, the Bristol Bay issue I know is kind of timely, and it's up in Alaska. About 2 years from now, they're going to be starting that project in some form. But let's say you want to upset that apple cart as a person working and living in Bristol Bay. How exactly would you do that? You've mentioned Twitter and Facebook, but...
Well, and if you go to the savebristolbay.org, you'll see that a number of techniques that they've used. They've got some great PDFs to download that have got the facts and the data that are easy to email around. Like I said, they've got their corporate partners who have been pushing it out to their email lists to raise awareness of the issue. And then you've got actual people to contact, fishing guides, subsistence fisher people. And so you've got real stories that are being told on the website and then also through Facebook.
Okay,
and so, YouTube.
And this, so much of this is defining the problem and creating a compelling story to follow and track and watch and monitor over time.
And for some of us, it's so insane, we can't even believe that you're even having the conversation,
right.
You know,
right.
For the gain of so few people and at the expense and potential downfall of so much. And such a really the world's treasure.
Yeah. And I think in the past, a lot of these types of development projects, you know, the information wasn't available.
Right.
I mean, it was the industries controlled the information, so it was just not known. And that's the beauty of this. You kind of release the dam, so to speak, on the information and get it out there. And that can really make a lot of change.
Yeah, the transparency on these issues seems just amazing with social media now.
And it helps with the fact that there is so much information out now, too. You know, there's a lot of information fatigue, and just in terms of the absolute volume of it. And I think that's one of the places that social media is helping to filter and getting each of us information that is relevant and interesting to us much simpler and easier. Just saw a usage study that showed that people under 25 are not using search engines at the same rate that they're using social media. So even this idea of going out and getting information for yourself is way more heavy in terms of time and attention versus making a post on Facebook of, hey, where have you eaten lately that you enjoyed? Or I'm going to Austin, where should I go shopping? So the idea that search engines are going to be out of date, that took me by surprise, but now I understand a little bit more why that is.
That's interesting.
Yeah, that is interesting. Well, and lastly, you know, one thing I think that's important here is that the amount of information that we're exposed to through every media type, social media, radio, et cetera, it is overwhelming, as you mentioned. So sifting through information seems to be the next challenge for our brains that weren't designed to cope with a million different things coming at us all the time. And I think, in fact, that's one of the strategies that I've seen employed by, let's say, industry or development interests on certain projects. They just bury projects in information. You might be a respondent to a lawsuit and receive 250 legal boxes full of information that you got to spend the next 6 months digging through. So in some ways, information overload is a big challenge in social media. How do you make your stories compelling, A, but not overwhelming and not depressing, but hopeful? How about optimistic? What are the possibilities of including those types of energies into a social media campaign?
Well, that's a good point. And content development is always what we struggle with, which is how do we develop this story and what do we lead with? Is it the shock, or is it a story about, you know, the little puppy? And it really depends, and everybody has different triggers. And so you've got to repackage, just like you can make a blog post that's 500 words and you can make a Twitter post that's 140 characters. You've got to be able to mix and match your message and your headlines so that it's interesting and appropriate for the medium that you're using.
Okay. Well, it's a really interesting topic. I want to thank both of you for joining me today.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Kirk.
Yeah, thank you. You've been listening to the EcoNews Report. I've been your host, Kirk Cahoon of Greenway Partners, and I was speaking today with Emmanuel Rose of Strategic eMarketing and David Narum of Greenway Partners. If you have questions or comments about this program, please call our listener comment line at 826-6089. EcoNews Report is produced for KHSU, located at Humboldt State University. Join us again next Thursday at 1:30 here on KHSU and KHSR.